Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Chris Abani. His novel, Graceland, has recently been published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. His book of poetry, Daphne's Lot, was published by Red Hen Press. He has an earlier book of poetry, as well as a thriller that he wrote when he was 16 years old. This is a case that I'm looking forward to discussing, because from the thriller, which was called Masters of the Board and was a kind of Nazi Third Reich thriller,
right.
The young man who wrote that novel was arrested in Nigeria and put into prison because it was claimed that the book had provided a blueprint for an attempted coup d'etat.
Correct.
And in prison, the author learned a level of political consciousness that led to poetry, playwriting,
right.
agitprop theater, that led to further arrests,
right.
and eventual repatriation, if I'm not mistaken, in London for a time.
Yes.
And then another book of poetry, which led him, interestingly, to the writing program at the University of Southern California.
Right.
And this novel, Graceland, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, which was written while in the creative writing program there.
Correct.
So you've got an interest in writing that's lifelong and blossoms more and more along literary and moral lines as
right.
you go along. And finally, the novel is interested, in a certain sense, in figuring out how a novel can talk about the unbearable experiences, a mixture of coincidence and then real integrity and commitment
right.
that led to imprisonment.
Right.
Now, what do writing teachers, Chris, tell you? Because they always begin by telling you, in the old days, they'd say, write about what you know.
Right.
And then they started to say, write about what you don't know.
Right.
And then they say, well, write about what you know that you have some distance on.
Right.
But what about your experiences, the kind that are, it seems to me, impossible to get distance on?
Right. Yeah. it's one of those sort of conundrums for a creative writing professor, in a sense, to be confronted with. A person has had a certain amount of life experience that is not necessarily ordinary, and to sort of try and direct that in terms of producing works of fiction or poetry. For me, I think what's been really wonderful about the program I'm in and the teachers I've had along the way, which have included people like Kwame Dawes for Calicutra Republic, is they've somehow, I think what happens is we have honest conversations, and we talk about how disturbing it is for them to sort of read some of the material I'm working with. And once we're able to sort of both confront that, then we sort of put that aside and it becomes pure carpentry. It becomes talking about craft in a sense. And one of the things that they've been able to do is because we're sort of fixed on working on the scaffolding of the material, it allows them to enter, to direct me in very useful ways. One of the most profound things is when I was working with Percival Everett, who said to me, the real trick to having, and it's not even the right word, it's not a trick, but the key to having integrity as a writer, not just dealing with difficult circumstances, but dealing with anything, is to be completely honest and vulnerable on the page. Totally. And that allows a reader to approach your work in a vulnerable state. And that sort of vulnerability means that you can't make easy choices. And the lines between morality become continuously blurred in a way that is often true of real life.
Now, I'm interested because, at the University of Southern California,
mm-hmm.
the two main fiction teachers mm-hmm. for several years have been Percival Everett and T.C. Boyle. Mm-hmm. And both of them take a satiric approach mm-hmm. to fairly painful mm-hmm. materials. Mm-hmm. In other words, in Tortilla Curtain,
right.
T.C. Boyle is writing about racial prejudice
right.
as he is in East is East.
Right.
But in East is East, everything gets resolved by the characters wandering seemingly by accident into a writing program.
Right, exactly. exactly.
As if writing workshops were the cure to a human malaise mm-hmm. that's much deeper. It seems to me that the material you bring to the room mm. is material that doesn't need the decal edge of ironic distance.
Right.
And I'm wondering how you began to shape the material in Graceland.
The thing about it is, say, my background, my mother is English, my father is Nigerian, and these are two... Both of these cultures are very ironic and sort of have a very dark sense of humor. And much of life is approached in this way. So it's almost satirical in a way, but not sort of in the exacerbated sense of it, but in this sort of almost subtle unstitching. And when I came to Graceland, what I had been trying to do was sort of build up. But when I started writing, I came to writing through thrillers. They were fascinating to me. I was a young man, and you can indulge all your 16-year-old fantasies about guns and women in them. And with sort of leaving prison and trying to then and growing up and coming to a point where you start to realize that this is art you're trying to make, and that art carries, it requires a certain integrity of you, but also carries a certain responsibility, which is a sort of total commitment to craft or to whatever your pursuit is. It became more. I sort of went through several phases of exploring different things, but I think the fundamental question that runs through all of my work is it possible for redemption? And if it's possible, at what point? And how far into darkness can you go before you can actually return? And so when I came to Graceland, some of it is my experience. With all first novels, it's inevitable that a lot of the author creeps into the work. And I say first novel because it's the first serious novel I've written, in a sense. And so the way in for me was to sort of ask fundamental questions, which is when is the birth of conscience for not just for a character in a novel, but for the writer writing the novel. And so it sort of became an attempt to come to terms with how conscience is developed and how flawed the notion of having a conscience is.
Well, I was amazed because when you do open the book, the first thing you see is a set of quotes in the book proper
right.
that are going to create a set of dichotomies.
Right.
The first quote is a quote from Amiri Baraka from
right.
his book Blues People, and then a quote from one of the stories by Bessie Head, one of the great
right.
African writers.
Right.
And immediately we have America, Africa,
right.
male, female.
Right.
And these are going to be the subject, the turf on which
right.
a certain battle of the book, who has control of the boy Elvis's
right.
consciousness, his mother dead
right.
and his grandmother, or his father and the sort of jailed presences that
right.
he's cultivated around himself. And it's a question about how do you become a man
right.
and where is your identity, your national identity
right.
in that mixture as well.
Right. Exactly.
Now, but placing Amiri Baraka against
right.
Bessie Head. Let's talk about that to begin with.
If we look at Bessie, for instance, Bessie Head was, like you said, one of the most incredible writers to emerge out of Africa. She was a South African writer, and much like myself, was biracial and bicultural, and was a woman who clearly was visceral and real and had a power in the world, but the process of apartheid And sort of patriarchy forced her almost into a mental disorder. And writing for her became a way to try and articulate the validity of herself in the world. So that always fascinated me. And we share similar experiences. So I thought, this is wonderful. And how she's always questioning this notion of essentialism within Africa, because it's a big problem. Most of our wars are fought over the notion of purity, ethnic purities, and so forth. So in a sense, the questions of what is an African became important to me, because as a Nigerian, but more importantly as an Igbo, you don't think of yourself as an African except when you're in context of the world, larger society. So the quote from her, and it's also how all these different forces of colonialism and so forth have fed together to almost deconstruct what could be an essential African. And so ironically, the first quote sort of is along the lines of, so vast as had his perceptions become, that he was no longer, he could hardly be called an African in a way. And it was sort of tongue-in-cheek in that way. And Baraka, for me, is an intriguing character and always has been. There are several reasons for this. There's an exchange of art between African-Americans and Africans on the continent that's been overlooked for a long time. Acknowledgements in music are made, with, say, Fela Kuti coming over here, meeting Roy Ayers, becoming a Black Panther-infused person, going back and forming a whole new form of African consciousness. But the literature has been overlooked. And I grew up reading Baldwin and Ellison and all these people, and that's influenced me tremendously. So I wanted to bring that kind of dialogue together, but I wanted to sort of point to certain characters or certain positions that would occur within masculinity or the performance of masculinity within the context of the book, particularly with people like the King of the Beggars, who's one of the characters. And so I chose Baraka because of the polemic tendency he has in his work, which I think sometimes there's a raw energy to it, which is viable, but the danger to it, of course, becomes that art becomes sacrificed to politics, but also that there is a romanticism to some of his work in how he talks about Africa or Africans that I thought was intriguing and needed to be deconstructed.
Now, I'm speaking to Chris Abani about his novel Graceland, and we're about to actually discuss the novel. It seemed necessary to bring in these backgrounds because the hero of the book is a young man named Elvis. He is an Elvis impersonator, or wants to be.
Right.
He's a dancer, which brings for his father and even for the women the question of his sexuality.
Right.
At a certain point, they braid his hair and they paint him. But another ritual has also involved painting him and bringing him to the forest. So there has been always a doubling.
Right.
He is transvestite in the sense that he is a transvestite of Elvis, which is, one might say, a sex unto itself.
Right. Well, that's true.
Yes.
That's true.
And so this book begins in all kinds of ironic double consciousness and reflections.
Right.
When I first read the book, I said, oh my, this is going to be very easy. He's going to have to stop imitating Elvis and become himself.
Right.
But in fact, not so easy to do in a country in which his discovery of self is going to be through imprisonment.
Right. If you put a character, an individual of any sort, in extremity, in a moment of extremity, the things that are facade eventually begin to crack. And there is a moment then of choice, and the easy choice for him would have been to continue struggling, regardless of the fact that he would never have made any impact as sort of this popular figure performing, or to sort of face up to the moment when he has to find himself, he has to inhabit himself as a person, and part of that is tied up with how you become a man in a culture where there's a confusion. There's a lot of masquerades, and all the rituals, as you've pointed out, involve painting, they involve wearing masks, men perform as women in sort of the cult mysteries. So that there is this sort of constant transvestism going on, and the masculinity becomes an ambiguous performance. And I just wanted to sort of focus on that ambiguity in a way that means it can never find a resolution. And if it did find a resolution, what a sad world it would be, in a way.
Now, we're in a ghetto, which is marshy. It's a liquid place.
Right.
In other words, he is in a state of maximal disorder at the beginning of the book,
yes.
A confusion between land and sea, border and borderlessness. Someone has erected a bunch of boards over the mud so that you can get to your work in the morning.
Right.
But his work in the morning, that first morning, is going to the beach, putting talcum powder on his face, and performing for tourists.
Right.
He's not, it seems, whatever his dreams, a particularly good Elvis impersonator.
No, he's not. He's not at all. He's a very bad one. Because I talk about him, you know, he sings off key and, yeah, definitely.
And so what is it, what is he yearning for in that impersonation?
I would think ultimately he's yearning for acceptance. And it's a curious way that that plays out because this is a reversal of blackface.
So
it becomes whiteface in a way, and it's you live in a schizophrenic situation as a modern, say, Nigerian, where you have all the trappings of a Westerner, and you have still got a lot of the sensibilities from an older culture. Culture has been interrupted in a sense, so that those sensibilities have never fully realized themselves, and then you're caught within these two demands, and so you're constantly seeking acceptance. Both at the family level, which we see occurring for him, in nationhood, because what is a nation with 300 ethnic groups thrust together arbitrarily? But also, it's also this need for acceptance from the West, this need to participate and be seen as all equal or all the same. So on all these levels, this kid is seeking acceptance in so many different ways, and just the Elvis in person. And also, his mother dies. His mother dies when he's a kid. All he has of her are these recipes, this book of recipes, in a sense, which are the ephemera of a culture that's vanishing, in a sense. And he has to try and make sense of it. And his mother dies, and he can't access her. And so, in a sense, a vital part of himself that is needed to grow is missing. So he's seeking all these kind of acceptances. He needs his father's endorsement. I had a peculiar situation with my father because we had opposing views. He worked for a government that I didn't particularly like. And that sort of conflict created situations where he publicly shamed me in certain situations where he sort of disowned me as a son in a culture where you are your family before you're your individual self. And in a sense, I was not a man as far as my father was concerned, because I was more interested in love, in not in a Hallmark way, but in this sort of notions of fluidity, in this ideas of words and the power of them, but didn't fit this category of otherness, say like a homosexual, where he could then invest hate very easily into this othering position. And he died, and this is also about becoming a man, because he died, and Elvis's father dies too, without giving him the stamp of approval, which I think young men need from their fathers to feel that they're men. And so constantly the flux of his sexuality, even his thought process, his devolvement into the life of crime with redemption, is again looking for that masculine approval constantly.
Now, by the way, I'm speaking to Chris Abani about his novel Graceland, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And you're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. It struck me that this is a picaresque novel,
right,
a kind of somewhere between Candide and Huckleberry Finn, in a way. You know, because it's adventures between guilt and innocence,
right,
and reality and idealism, but also improvisations between black and white.
Right.
In a culture that doesn't really allow for that kind of improvisation.
Right.
The movement in the book is toward the prison, from the marsh to the prison. In other words, from disorder to over-vigilant order.
Right.
From the liquid to the cement.
Right.
And there, what would you say it is that he learns from that experience?
I think what happens for most of us is that we go from this sort of almost amoebic state of consciousness where everything is possible and everything is fluid. And then as we begin to progress along life, we sort of start to fall into these fixed roles. And we never really question how we come to be. And that's another thing. All my characters are very surreal, almost bizarre in their construction. And they certainly exist. If you just walk down Santa Monica Boulevard, you would see them. They exist. But for me, these individuals, they live so far outside what's easy to understand that they can begin to function as metaphor through which we begin to realize almost how we come to be who we are. And so as he moves towards this sort of overbearing order, which in many ways becomes the trappings of perceived maturity, for me to see how that comes to be, or to see how it would hold up, putting him in an extreme position where that order becomes overbearing, it would be the same as if you went to war, like the young men who went to war in Vietnam at 19 and come back. They've gone from sort of the looseness of an American culture into a strict military regime and then become extremely damaged. And for me, that's essentially what I'm looking at, that the possibility for redemption or for transformation does not lie in an erasure of either the sort of fluidity. It doesn't lie, A, in a movement from fluidity to this solid position. Neither does it lie in an erasure of any of them. It's about sort of coming to terms with the notion that intrinsically, to become whole, you have to be damaged.
Well, it's also, for him, about learning to dance.
Essentially.
There's a difference between imitating and dancing.
There is indeed.
And his impulse to imitate Elvis is not very much different from the impulse in a ballroom dancing class of these people to want to be able to imitate an official evening so that they can progress along hierarchical lines in their jobs. We see a dancing teacher. He escapes to the movies. He watches Fred Astaire. Mm-hmm. And he also likes to watch Elvis Presley movies. And they have tied these dancing students to wooden crosses in order to improve their posture, but of course in order to make a neat allegorical statement about what it is for an African to learn rituals outside his own culture.
Right.
And there's a lot of play about Christianity
in
this book, and the Scottish missionaries who not only have brought Christianity to the boy's grandmother, but their accent as well.
Right.
She speaks as if wearing a kilt.
Exactly.
So it's about learning how to move gracefully.
Essentially.
Without necessarily being taught rigorous steps.
Yes. And it's interesting you point that out because the novel is essentially about dancing. I mean, like you say, there are all these sequences. Because as a young man coming to consciousness in Africa, there is a dance expected of you all the time. There is a dance that the men in your community expect of you to dance, to perform your masculinity, or even from the women folk in a certain way. There is a dance that the West expects from you as a good African. And then, of course, as you point out, there is the movement where you actually move from imitating dance to when you acquire almost this thing which I think Lorca calls duende, where the movement becomes this graceful turning towards possibility, which is what eventually happens towards the end of the book.
Yeah. Well, I thought of also what Yeats talked about when he talked about the dancing masters of my soul.
Ah, that's interesting.
And suddenly I wanted to bring this, in a sense, full circle, because you go off to a writing school.
Right.
From the most formal kind of manipulated writing, the thriller. Your early novel, Masters of the Board, to the loosest kind of writing, free verse in Daphne's Lot and Calicut Republic. is suddenly the book, and what I sense here is that there's a war. There are teachers,
yes,
invisibly off page,
right,
saying beginning, middle, and end.
Right.
And yet there's a sensibility that says, well, does a cookbook have a beginning, a middle, and an end? What about the book of recipes?
Right.
This book seems to be about trying out steps.
Yes.
Under the tutelage of teachers.
Right.
And eventually seeing how far you can get.
Right.
Beyond the teacher's vigilance.
Yes. There is... Wow. That's wonderful.
Now, a strange and kind of metaphorical final question. Given that the writing
right,
has led you to institutions.
I love that.
To jail and to university.
To jail and university,
and
yeah,
to freedom.
Yes.
Afterwards. Where do you go metaphorically now?
That's interesting. Always to the underbelly, because freedom in itself is an institution in which you can become caged in the notion of freedom. But what always fascinates me in life is that within every institution, and even outside it, that as one thing turns, as sort of the more visible turns on the top and creates structure, there is always the unstitching of life underneath it. And that it's the counterpoint between the stitching and unstitching as a space where true metaphor occurs. So always, my new book is set in East Los Angeles. It's set sort of in the what would be called the detritus of Los Angeles, not Hollywood, not any of those sort of areas. And again, all the characters are strange, bizarre people who function as beacons through which we understand our own making. So I think for me that's still where it works.
Out of the university and into the streets.
Into the streets.
I've been talking with Chris Abani, author most recently of Graceland, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you, Chris, for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You can read an excerpt from Graceland on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Harrod and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book. Off the mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.